Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dorothy Gundy and Anna Mateo. Later, Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report. Steve Tracy was not looking for a job at the Community College of Baltimore County when he started taking classes there in August. But the 25-year-old from Catonsville, Maryland, did find a job almost by accident. One day, while walking to class, Tracy saw an advertisement for a student group that looked interesting. So he went to the school's Office of Student Life to learn more about it. Someone working there told him that the group was no longer active. But after a pleasant exchange, the worker ended up offering Tracy a part-time job in her office, and Tracy accepted.
He now helps student groups plan events. He provides them with the materials and any other assistance they might need. Tracy says having the extra money from this job is helpful. Also, he works with several other students in what he calls a fun environment. And he loves seeing an event come together successfully. But most important of all, Tracy says, is how the job makes him feel connected to the college. I'm on campus a lot more, so I definitely feel like I'm a bigger part of the community, he told VOA. I get to help out other students and people that have problems. I've made a lot of connections that way.
Feeling more connected to one's school may not be the only good thing that comes from working while studying. In 2008, the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that working students performed better in their classes than those who did not. On average, grades of students who worked up to 20 hours per week were higher than those without jobs. All these students were in their first year at a four-year college or university in the United States. However, it is not just having a job that can help students. What they do in their jobs not only can help them in their studies, but also in their lives after school. For example, Tracy says he has learned through his campus job how to use computer programs that he did not understand before. He says he will most likely need those computer skills in his future career. That is why some colleges and universities are doing more to provide work experiences for students that do more than just give them financial aid. Clemson University in Clemson, South Carolina, is one such example. Clemson is a public research university. The school is far from any major city. This means there are few places for Clemson students to find meaningful employment elsewhere. So, in 2011, the administration asked Neil Burton, head of the school's Center for Career and Professional Development, to make some changes.
The university wanted Burton to develop a program that was not just a way of creating more jobs. He says, Clemson wanted its students to have special positions that would teach them valuable skills related to their interests or field of study. It also wanted the students to be working in professional environments, ones that would provide useful experience in their job searches after college. Burton says Clemson wanted to employ 500 students in these positions by 2020. And so the University Professional Internship and Co-op Program, or UPIC, was born. The program works like this. Any Clemson professor or employee in need of professional help can prepare a proposal. This could be a biology professor looking for a research assistant, or an administrator who needs help raising donations for the school, Burton says. It can also be any outside organization that works with Clemson, such as a company that is designing new buildings for the campus. Burton and his team decide if the position satisfies the requirements of the program and then list the job on Clemson's website. Students ask to be considered for the job and go through an interview process. If they are accepted, students are permitted to work in that position for one semester. They also are required to take a class that informs them of what to expect in the position before they start. Finally, at the end of the term, students are tested on what they have learned from the experience. Students can apply for positions through UPIC as many times as they want.
UPIC has been a success from the very start, Burton says. By 2013, the program helped about 125 Clemson students find part-time employment. Word of the program's success spread across South Carolina. So the state government said it wanted to help. It promised to provide the school with $1 million every year to support the program. By 2014, Clemson had 626 students working through UPIC. And Burton believes the program could help over 1,000 students by 2018. Burton adds that this is not just a success for the school. He notes that students who take part in the program are 20% more likely to have a full-time job offer once they complete their studies. This can be even more important for students who have little money of their own. A lot of those students, especially if they're first generation, are not going to have the same kind of professional network that a student coming from a middle-class family might have, Burton told VOA. And this is a way to help those students so that they've got some people here on campus who can provide guidance. This kind of program is not only popular in the United States. Ryerson University in Toronto, Canada, has taken similar measures.
Caroline Conrad is the director of the Career Center at Ryerson, which is also a public research university. She says her school already employs about 1,000 students every year. But 3 years ago, she notes, Ryerson wanted to provide its students with more of an educational experience through those positions. So, Conrad says, her office began holding meetings with students and their employers to learn how it could make improvements. With the information gained from those meetings, the office developed a system to identify learning goals for students in any campus position. These goals relate to skills, like communication and teamwork, that students could use in their careers, Conrad says. But they also include respecting people and treating others equally in the workplace. Conrad argues this is especially important as Ryerson prepares students to shape the world around them.
We view our students as the future leaders of a society which we all want to live in, she told VOA. And fundamental to that is the professional environments which we are all creating. And so, when we talk about equity on company boards, that really starts all the way down when individuals are building their careers. In 2016, Ryerson developed a system for measuring how well campus jobs help students reach its goals for valued learning. For example, Conrad notes, if a student's job is designing advertising, the employer should ensure the student includes not just one race or sex in the ads. After all, Conrad says, every day spent in college should help prepare students for what comes after, not just classwork. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Welcome to Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. On today's program, we will talk about several very common expressions. Even though these expressions use simple language, English learners may find them difficult to understand. In fact, native English-speaking children often have trouble too. Speaking of children, what child doesn't like to jump around and act silly sometimes? Monkeys are also known for acting silly. So, when kids act up, parents or teachers may tell them to stop monkeying around. To monkey around means to do things that are not useful or serious, or to simply waste time. Now, in the United States, children do not usually have monkeys as pets, but they do often have dogs. And dogs make most children feel happy. But for some reason, a reason that word experts do not know, we use dog in a phrase that means to feel unwell. If you are as sick as a dog, you are really, really sick and will most likely stay home from work or school. Besides dogs, cats are also a favorite pet here in the States. This next phrase combines cats and secrets to make a very common expression. Let's say you know a secret, a big secret. And let's say you tell it to people. You have just let the cat out of the bag. This idiom means to reveal a secret or tell facts that were previously unknown. If you let the cat out of the bag, you spoil a surprise. So, if your friend is planning a big surprise birthday for another friend, don't let the cat out of the bag by accidentally saying it in front of the birthday girl. Even though this is a very common idiom, the origin of to let the cat out of the bag is also unknown. However, the origin of our next expression is not hard to guess. If you are doing an outdoor activity, such as hiking in the woods or having a picnic in the park, what are some things that may disturb your good time? Bad weather could, and so could bugs. Crawling pests like ants and flying ones like mosquitoes could make your experience uncomfortable or annoying. So, when we bug people, we bother them so much that we affect their good time. This common expression is often said as a command, "Stop bugging me." Now let's move on to clothing. Of course, you know what a hat is. But did you know that you can wear many at the same time? If you wear many hats, you do many different things, even if you only have one job. For example, if you work at a small company, the owners may expect you to answer the phones, manage paperwork, speak to clients, and design the website. In today's economy, some people say it is good to wear many hats when you are first starting your career. While wearing my researching hat here at Learning English, I have learned that many languages use food in their idioms and expressions. English is no exception. Some food expressions have good meanings, while others don't. For example, being a couch potato is not a good thing. This means you sit on the couch all day and do nothing but watch television or play video games. People who are couch potatoes are thought to be lazy and boring. Life does not excite them. They would rather watch others live on a screen. Now let's say a friend of yours is a couch potato. You may wonder how he got to be that way. One day you visit this friend's home and meet his mother and father. While you are there, you see the parents are also couch potatoes. You could say, "Well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree." This expression simply means that a child acts or looks a lot like the parents. Usually, we use this expression when talking about bad things. But we can also use it to describe good traits that are passed down from a parent to a child. We use the next two expressions when we have problems. One deals with your heart, and the other with your bank account. Sometimes in life, we run into serious issues. They might require a conversation with someone about an uncomfortable or unpleasant topic. We call this kind of conversation a heart-to-heart. We use this expression as a noun or as an adjective, such as a heart-to-heart talk. But perhaps having a heart-to-heart doesn't help to solve a problem. Let's say you are having trouble paying your rent. Having a heart-to-heart with your landlord may gain you a couple of weeks, but soon you will have to pay your rent. The only thing to really help this problem is money. However, money can't and shouldn't help all problems. Also, it's not a good idea to try to solve big problems with just money. But sometimes, people do just throw money at a problem and hope that it goes away. For example, people having trouble learning English may try to throw money at the problem. They may buy classes, time with teachers, and the latest language software. But these things will get them only so far. To really get better, they must simply study and practice. And that's all for this Words and Their Stories. I'm Ana Mateo.
This week, we visit one of the most unusual national parks in the United States. It is called the Dry Tortugas National Park. It includes 7 small islands. They are about 200 kilometers off the coast of the state of Florida. One of the islands was once a prison. The first European to see the small islands was the Spanish explorer Ponce de León. He arrived by ship in 1513. Ponce de León was an older man who was searching for special water that stories said would make him young again. It was called the Fountain of Youth. Ponce de León named the islands the Tortugas. Tortuga is the Spanish word for turtle. Thousands of turtles lived on the islands. Ponce de León was able to capture many of these creatures to provide meat for his ship's crew. He never did find the Fountain of Youth. In fact, the islands had no fresh water on them at all. The tortugas were dry. The word dry began to appear on early maps of the area to warn ships that they could not find fresh water there. Centuries later, America's third president, Thomas Jefferson, took an interest in the islands. He hoped they could become a place that could help protect ships traveling in a large area of water called the Florida Straits. He proposed a military base be built there. In 1821, the United States took control of Florida and its islands. Construction of a military fort began in 1848, long after Jefferson's death. The fort was to be the home of 1,500 men and 450 huge cannons. The fort's name? Fort Jefferson. Fort Jefferson was never really completed. It had to be worked on continually. The salt air, wind, water, and sand quickly caused problems. The weight of the fort's heavy brick walls made them sink into the sand. Slaves and prisoners did the building and repair work at the fort. Many of the prisoners were army troops. They had been found guilty of crimes and ordered to serve their sentences at Fort Jefferson. In July of 1865, 4 new prisoners arrived at Fort Jefferson. They had been found guilty of taking part in the successful plot to murder the President of the U.S., Abraham Lincoln. One of the prisoners was sentenced for giving medical aid to the man who killed President Lincoln. He was also found guilty of being an active member of the assassination plot. That man was Samuel Alexander Mudd. He was a 32-year-old doctor from the state of Maryland. He was sentenced to spend the rest of his life doing hard labor at Fort Jefferson. The walls at Fort Jefferson were about 15 meters tall. Inside the walls of the fort were hundreds of rooms. Most of them held guns that pointed out to the sea. Many other buildings were also inside the huge fort. No prisoner had ever successfully escaped from Fort Jefferson. It was more than 200 kilometers across open ocean to the nearest occupied land. Samuel Alexander Mudd must have believed the fort would be his home for the rest of his life, but he was wrong. In 1867, Dr. Mudd was helping the prison doctor treat victims of yellow fever. Many people died from yellow fever. Soon, the prison doctor lost his own battle with the disease. Only Dr. Mudd was left to treat the increasing number of men who became sick with yellow fever. Later, the sickness seemed to leave the island. Many of those who survived knew they owed their lives to Dr. Mudd. Almost every man in Fort Jefferson wrote to the President of the United States, asking that Mudd be pardoned because of his work treating patients with yellow fever. They called Mudd a hero. In February of 1869, President Andrew Johnson signed a presidential pardon. Mudd was a free man. He left Fort Jefferson and returned to his home in Maryland. He once again became a family doctor. In 1874, the American Army left Fort Jefferson. Modern artillery made the fort no longer useful. Today, the old fort and empty little islands provide a protected home for thousands of birds, fish, and sea turtles. Visitors travel for hours on high-speed boats that bring them to the islands from Key West, Florida. They swim in the warm waters and enjoy the bright Florida sun. Many try snorkeling or scuba diving to explore the underwater shipwrecks. Still others bring tents and spend a few days living on the white sand beaches. Thousands of visitors make the trip to the Dry Tortugas National Park every year. Of course, soldiers no longer greet them when they arrive at Fort Jefferson. Now, friendly members of the National Park Service do. They meet every boat filled with visitors. They smile and say, "Welcome to Fort Jefferson and the Dry Tortugas National Park." The small island's days as a prison are long past. Yet, almost every visitor to the park asks about its most famous prisoner, Dr. Samuel Alexander Mudd. They ask to see his room. Most people know that the doctor did not end up spending the rest of his life in the Fort Jefferson prison. Only a few of the huge cannons remain at the park. They help show visitors what the old fort looked like. The weather continues to affect the fort's grounds and buildings, so workers continue to fight against environmental damage. The park extends over an area of more than 26,000 hectares. Almost all of this is ocean and living coral reefs that protect the islands. Many ships have sunk in the waters around the islands over the centuries. The wrecks of these ships help provide safe places for many fish. Thousands of kinds of fish live in these waters. Some visitors are even lucky enough to see sea turtles swimming in the clear blue waters. Dry Tortugas is also home to many seabirds. Visitors are not permitted on some of the islands within the park to protect birds that are laying eggs. The striking natural beauty and relaxed feel of the islands today seems far different from Dry Tortugas' earlier history as a lonely, inescapable prison. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.